Many of you perhaps have read Bret Hart's wonderful little story of Christmas at Roaring Camp, located up in the Sierra Nevadas back in the Gold Rush days. At our house, we've been listening to Bing Crosby singing Christmas in Killarney, and that's somewhat unusual. And then there's Christmas in Hawaii, and we've been listening to what Christmas in Mississippi is like. And so I feel somewhat justified in looking in with you on a Christmas celebration in the ancient land of Uz, found in the book of Job, of all places. Job, the 42nd chapter. Just two verses out of this book and this small chapter, but we have a description of this. The Lord, it says, restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. And then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before, and they ate bread with him in his house, and they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. Doesn't that sound like Christmas? Well, you say, thank you, thank you. I have one discerning listener here this morning. And the rest of you unbelievers, the rest of you unbelievers are saying, wait a minute. Come on, there's no Christmas in that. Why, this was long before Christmas ever was known. This is 2,000 years before Christ came. How could there be Christmas in this book of Job? I was told some time ago that a couple of people from this congregation were discussing my sermons one morning. And one of them said, I don't see how he gets out of the text all that he finds there. I read that and I don't see those things. And the other person said, well, that's a very simple explanation of that, because they're not in there, that's why. Well, the Bible's a wonderful book. And the most wonderful thing I think about it is the way it's built. The fact that it is a collection in many ways of stories. Wonderful stories. The most beautiful and marvelous stories in all the world. And all of us have grown up with these stories and fascinated by them. And whenever they appear on television or in the movies, they still are of tremendous popular appeal. And the reason for that is these stories are more than just stories. They are historical things that actually happened in the world of history, but also they're pictures, God's picture book, in which He's showing us what goes on inside of us as well, the inner story of every life. And that's why the Bible never gets out of date, never gets old and dusty. If we think it's that way, it's because we failed to catch the glory and the brightness and the beauty of some of these stories. And so here in this book of Job, we have a story that I think, if we look at it very closely, does indeed resemble Christmas and has a Christmas theme to it. Let's look at it together and see what we can find. The very first thing you note about this is that this occasion that's described here is a family gathering. Job's brothers and sisters, we don't know how many, and all his friends who had known him before are getting together on this occasion. The uncles and the aunts, and of course with them all the cousins and the nephews and the nieces and all the children and the grandchildren. By this time, Job is a man 70 years of age or more, and he must have, though his own children had all perished, there must have been perhaps grandchildren and great-grandchildren by now, and all the neighbors and friends brought their families, so that this was a great family occasion, such as Christmas is for us as well, and always has been. There's nothing like the family together at Christmas. I think many of you here are here because you've come home for Christmas and to be with the family. And our songs reflect the idea there's no loneliness like being alone at Christmas, away from the family and the friends. And the nostalgia of this season is all centered around that warm circle of family and friends together around the Christmas tree or around the family hearth. We associate that with Christmas, and it's always been that way from the very beginning of the Christmas story. Then the second thing you see here is that this was a time of feasting together. It says that they all gathered and ate bread with him in his house. Now, surely they had more than bread, because this is a metaphorical expression for a tremendous feast. They gathered together to eat together, and we do that the same way today. We start with stuffed turkey, and we end with stuffed people. And this has always been the custom at Christmas. In medieval times, according to the descriptions we have, they used to go out in the forest and kill a wild boar and bring it in and roast it and that would be the center of the feast at Christmas. That's B-O-A-R. I know some B-O-R-E's I'd like to roast at Christmas, but that's not what this is talking about. The menu has differed for Christmas feasts in many parts of the world. In England, until the most recent times, it was a Christmas goose. And you remember, if you read the writings of Charles Dickens, how he describes in mouth-watering terms the appearance of the Christmas goose. And in the south of our country, oftentimes ham is the center of the Christmas feast. I don't know what you're going to have. I don't know what they had here in Job's feast, but they had something. In Bible times, of course, often it was a calf that was roasted at Christmas time. You all remember the story of the prodigal son who came home and his father killed the fatted calf. One teacher telling the story in Sunday school asked, in reference to the elder brother, who was sorry when the prodigal son came home? And a little boy raised his hand and she called on me. He said, the fatted calf. And I don't know whether they had a fatted calf in Job's house. I would guess, and this is purely a guess, coming from what we familiarly call here the Steadmaniac translation of the Bible, is that they maybe had a roast ostrich. Because Job mentions this bird a little earlier in his book and tells us how easy it was to catch an ostrich. He was kind of a stupid animal, and God had made him that way. And I don't know whether they had a roast ostrich, but for a big occasion like this, they'd have to have something about that size. Maybe they made a huge omelet out of a dozen ostrich eggs. Whatever it was, they had a great feast on this great occasion here, and everybody had plenty to eat. And then there was a third thing here that I think associates itself with Christmas, and that's what we would call fellowship. It says they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought about him. They just gathered together to express understanding of all the pain and suffering he'd been going through, and to comfort him and to express their sympathy with him for what he had been enduring. At our home, we have two brand new neighbors. We have not two, but a couple brand new neighbors who've moved in with their children. And they're refugees from Vietnam. They're Vietnamese people who had once fled from the communist threat from North Vietnam into South Vietnam. And then later, when the communists took over, the war was lost in Vietnam, they fled from that country as well and came here to the United States, leaving everything behind and starting over life again here. And so last Friday night, we gathered together several families right around us in the neighborhood and went over to welcome them and make them feel at home and to comfort them and sympathize with them for the pressures they'd been under and the losses they had experienced and to make them feel welcome. And surely nothing is more typical of the spirit of Christmas than to express comfort and sympathy for those who have endured hardship and trial and difficulty during the year. We gathered together for that very occasion. But there's a strange note here. It says that as they gathered with Job on this occasion, they comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. That's a strange way to put it, isn't it? Usually, when we get together at Christmas, we're rejoicing for all the grace that God has shown to us and thanking Him for all the blessings that have come our way. But here they comforted Job, it says, because of all the evil which the Lord had brought upon him. Now, I believe that at this point, Job interrupted them. Doesn't say that here, I understand that. And this is one of the things perhaps you'll charge me of reading into the text. But I can't believe that this dear old patriarch, who had been going through months and months of pain and suffering almost beyond description, whom God has at last spoken to directly, and at our last view of him, we found him on his face before the Lord, repenting, crying out to him. I don't think that dear old man would let this go by, that these neighbors and friends and brothers and sisters would come in and seek to accuse God of bringing evil into his life and comforting him for that. I believe that if we have a vivid imagination, we can just picture this scene with all these people gathered in the living room and a big fire in the fireplace, and they're all talking to him about how terrible it was what he went through and what evil the Lord had brought on him. And Job lifts his hand and says, "Now wait a minute, friends. Wait a minute. You've got it all wrong. Let me explain some things to you. Once I thought like you did. There was a time when I thought too that these things that happened to me were evil things. You remember the time when in one tragic day all my children were killed in a terrible whirlwind that blew down the house they were in, and they all perished, 7 fine sons and 3 beautiful daughters, all gone in one day. And on that same day, the tribes around came and stole away my cattle and my camels and my asses and all the animals that I had, and I was impoverished and heartbroken all in one day. And some of you will remember that I took it in good stride and I said, well, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Because I did trust God. I believed He was my friend. And I had done my very best to walk before Him in the best way I knew how. And I believed that if He brought this kind of thing, it was only a momentary thing and that He would make up to me for it. But it didn't happen that way. As many of you know, he said, I began to develop these awful boils. You can see the scars on my hands and arms and face. And all over my body I have scars like that from these terrible boils that just tormented me day and night, tortured me. Till I sat in the dust heap, just scraping them off the running pus with potsherds, broken pieces of pottery. And I waited for this to pass. I thought it was only a temporary thing, but it kept going on and on and on, unrelieved. And I began to doubt. Friends, I began to doubt. I began to wonder whether God was indeed the God of love and justice that He said He was, that He claimed to be. And then I began to complain. And you know how I voiced my complaint and told you all how I felt. And finally, I began to charge God with evil, just as you have said today. I said these things were evil things, and God had no right to bring them, and it was unfair for me to be subjected to this kind of treatment. And as you know, it was all made worse by three tiresome old do-gooders who wanted to help me, but they literally drove me up the wall with their accusations. And I have to admit, friends, that I said some mean things back to them as well, because I was hurting so bad. But you know something? I've discovered that God was not doing evil to me at all. I discovered that He was teaching me two mighty truths that I've come to learn through that time of trial and hardship and pressure and pain that are so marvelous, so wonderful, that if I didn't know them now, I would gladly go through all I've gone through before this. I'd go through it again and again and again that I might learn these truths. Let me share them with you, friends. First thing God showed me, He showed me that I had a mediator. Now, I didn't know that before, Job said. I never knew there was a mediator before. I didn't think I needed one between me and God. God, I regarded as my friend and as my faithful supplier of all my needs. And if I would walk before Him as He wanted me to, He would give everything in my life that I needed and give me prosperity and peace and blessing. And I didn't think I needed anybody between me and God. But as this pain went on and all these terrible boils got worse and worse and nothing would ever relieve them, I discovered that I felt very far removed from God. God was great and pure and holy and powerful, and I kept seeing myself as weak and hurting and fragile and limited and all alone. And I kept asking myself, how could a God of great power and of terrible might and wisdom, how could He know how I would feel? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized how impossible it would be for God to know how I was feeling. And I began to feel sorry for myself. And then I began to see that there had to be some way by which the two of us could be brought together. I remember crying out on one occasion, oh, that there were a daysman, a mediator who could lay his hand on God and on me and bring us together. And you know, friends, the Spirit of God in my heart began to teach me something. And I began to see that there was a mediator that God had in mind. And I remember on one occasion, I saw it so clearly, I cried out and said, I know that my witness is in heaven, and He who vouches for me is on high. And I didn't know how this mediator would work or what he would do, but I knew that God Himself somehow would work to bring together my poor, fragile, limited, hurting, suffering being and His greatness and power and might and glory. And I saw that so clearly one day that I cried out, I know that my Redeemer lives and on the earth one day shall stand. And though the skin worms destroy this body, yet with my flesh I shall see my God. Now, friends, I don't know when He's going to come. But the Spirit of God has taught me that one of these days God is going to send a Redeemer. And already, because He's God, I can lay hold of the benefits of that work. It's coming in the future, and I don't know when, Job said. I don't know, it'll probably be at a time when the whole earth is like me, come to the end of my rope. When all the wisdom of the philosophers has failed, And all the military might of the greatest nations of earth has been unable to bring about peace on earth. And men everywhere have given up and are sunken in hopeless despair. Then, I believe, then God will act and a Redeemer will come. I know that my Redeemer lives and on the earth shall stand. And I don't know how he's going to come. But having learned something of the nature of God, I believe that it's not going to be in some pretentious display of glory. God doesn't work that way. Our God, I've learned, is a lover of humility. And I don't believe he'll come then as a great and mighty king with a retinue of followers displaying open glory. But knowing God as I've come to know him, I believe he'll probably come in some obscure place, hardly known by anybody, and from some hidden, obscure couple that nobody ever heard anything of. Perhaps by then he'll come into the world. He may even come as a tiny little baby, the most helpless object there is in all the universe. That would be like God to do it that way. But Job says, there's a second thing that I've learned through this, my friend. Not only did I learn to know that I had a mediator, but God also showed me the problem that the Redeemer had to handle. He showed me the problem of evil, how dark and ugly it is, and how powerful it is beyond description. God took me on a tour, Job says to these friends. God took me on a tour and showed me the wisdom he had manifested in the creation. And finally, he showed me the power of evil symbolized by two great beasts, ferocious, unconquerable, invincible dragons breathing fire out of their mouth. And God showed me that those two invincible beasts, reflecting of an ugliness and an evil that was beyond description, was located in my own heart. And I saw in me the self-centeredness of the flesh, which nothing I could do could get rid of. And the awful love of praise and glory and power of the world around me, which I had taken pride in the way my righteousness had given me standing before others. And friends, I had to humble myself and to see that God had simply brought me to a place where I'd seen the way things really are, and that I couldn't deliver myself, but I was cast upon His grace. And you know, friends, when that happened, something wonderful happened. I don't know how it happened. I didn't even expect it to happen. But when I repented, when I saw that it was God's problem and not mine, and that He alone could handle it, the Spirit of my Redeemer did something about it. He brought God and me together. And I knew my sins were forgiven. And peace flooded my heart like I've never known before. And you know, in the days that followed, my sores began to heal. Nothing had helped them before, but now they began to clear up. And as you can see, there's only scars left. And you know, friends, I don't care now whether I'm poor or rich. I really don't care whether I'm sick or well, or whether I'm all alone or with others, for the joy that I've found with my God and the peace that He's given me and the glory and the sense of forgiveness and the wonder of His love is so rich and so wonderful, it's worth everything I've gone through and much more beside. No, friends, God didn't send evil into my life. I don't need you to comfort me for that. God sent good. And I remember there's something I said back in the days when I was hurting that I didn't know fully what it meant. But I can say it again now with fresh and great meaning. And it's this: He knows the way that I take, and when He has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. And God did that, friends. So this was not evil. It was deliverance. And you know, there's a fourth thing here in this that reminds me of Christmas. And it's the giving of gifts. It says, "And each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold." Now, money is made of silver. And the ring was made of gold. And these friends then gave to Job gifts of gold, silver and gold. And in the Bible, all the way through, those two metals are used symbolically for a picture of redemption. Silver is the sign of redemption. And gold is the picture of deity. God redeeming man. That's why I say this is Christmas here in Job's house. And Job's witness to his friends evidently had such effect upon them that in thanksgiving and gratitude for what they learned from him, they gave him gifts of silver and gold to express their understanding of the redemption of God among men. And I wonder if this isn't a hint of why we give gifts at Christmas time. Not because we are looking for something back, that's the way the world gives. But Christians give gifts because they have already been made rich beyond compare. And they want to share it in some way with those who have less. And if Christmas means anything at all to us, then it means what Job discovered 2,000 years before the cross and before the birth of Jesus at Bethlehem, that the one who was coming into the world would come as the angels sang to the shepherds, as the angel said to Mary, "You shall call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins." And I think this is what brings joy and gladness to every heart at Christmas time. If you know the Lord Jesus, you have the greatest gift God can ever give to man. And out of the richness of your life, if you know have that gift, you will find yourself gladly sharing of all that you have with those who have less, that there might be the ringing out of joy and thanksgiving on a season like this. Well, perhaps you think me far-fetched on this, I don't know. But I believe we're justified in seeing that this was a Christmas celebration 2,000 years before Christmas ever came. For that's the way God teaches His people.